Okay, so I'm here with Nacho Vigalondo. How are you doing, sir?
Yes, I'm spending the best New York morning of my life.
Really?
Attending the press of my first feature,
yeah.
Really, is in the United States.
So. So this is like your first actual press day, your first series of roundtables all clustered together in the States?
Or
I'm sure you had a lot of this.
My first press thing in New York.
Oh, I got it. Yeah, so this is big stuff here.
Well, when you're making a film, when you're making a film like this, there's a lot of things you can expect, a lot of things you shouldn't expect.
Yeah.
And I never dreamed of having a U.S. release in a city like this. So for me, being here is like a dream.
I'm curious, do you think that you're essentially kind of isolated from the Hollywood scene by making films in Spain? Like, you're able to make a film like this, which is very conceptual in its nature, perhaps more so than in Hollywood, which favors obviously large explosions and more flash on the screen as opposed to substance on the page. Is this an advantage for you, do you feel? Or you're kind of in this isolation of some sort? Or
I cannot complain because when I wanted to make Time Crimes, I wanted to make not only a first film, not only a debut film, a very debut film, a film that really felt like this act of wilderness or this act of craziness. Or I think a first film has to be an act of something unpredictable. And I wanted to make this film because this film is even in Spain, is a very bizarre thing. It's a very strange thing. Even there, we don't have a tradition of science fiction filmmakers.
Yeah.
We have science fiction writers, but not in movies. So I wanted to make a film like this, you don't know what to expect. You don't know what's going to happen in Spain. You don't know what's going to happen outside Spain.
Yeah.
So for me, the big surprise is that the movie is getting, for me, a lot of attention from Hollywood, from here. So I couldn't expect that.
Yeah.
Because of what you said, it's not the kind of film you can imagine attached to Hollywood.
This kind of film that could be made in America, perhaps, you know, two decades ago. You see, like, for example, Darren Aronofsky's The Wrestler. That's the kind of film that would have been made by a studio 20 years ago, and now it has to be released independently.
But that's something we have to celebrate. Things are moving faster.
Yeah.
For example, I don't like the idea of they making, adapting comic books like Watchmen or Sin City 10 or 20 years after the comics come to the shops. But for example, there are also recent comic books like Kick-Ass by Mark Millar, the Scottish writer, and they are yet making the film.
Yeah.
So things are moving faster in that sense, and I really appreciate that they're remaking Time Crimes 1 year after the movie hits theaters, the original one.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I'm so glad of this situation.
I wanted to ask about, just to get into the film, the pink bandaged head that pops up in the window reminded me, it was almost like a universal horror film, those lines. And I had to ask you about, does this stem from, I suppose, a love of old Hollywood to some degree? Why? What provoked that very sort of classical almost image compared to the flash that we were sort of distinguishing between current Hollywood films and like old Hollywood films?
I didn't have that in mind. When you're writing the script, when you're writing a script, sometimes the script is putting you into a nightmare. Sometimes it's giving you some gift. And in this case, when I was writing Time Crimes, I found out a monster inside the story. But the story itself gave me the monster.
Yeah.
I needed someone with a hidden face, with the scissors on the hand. So I found out that the story was building a monster. A monster that had these classic resonances you're telling.
Yeah.
So I feel so fortunate because when you have a monster in your movie, the movie gets better most of the times. Every movie with a monster is better than the same story without a monster. You can apply this to all the other, to every example. I don't know. If Million Dollar Baby had a monster, it would be a better film. Once you find a monster inside your film, in my case, it's something I have to celebrate for two reasons. It's a monster that sounds like a universal classic film monster, and at the same time, it's a pretty cheap Halloween costume. If the people likes your film, you can they can disguise as the Pink Mummy with few money on the a bandage, a scissors. So if you wanna dress like Freddy Krueger, it's more expensive than my monster in my film. So yeah. It's like giving something to the people.
Sure, sure.
To the people. In depression times, giving cheap monsters to the people is something I really appreciate.
I'm curious. I mean, you were talking about finding the monster in the script, and I actually wanted to ask you, was it easier for you to backtrack to the series of events that you had set up? I mean, this 1 hour, essentially, from that he goes back to the past, than it was to, say, kind of come up with new events that you had to constantly look back at what you had laid down when you were writing the script, and that this wrote itself because of this, or was it a situation in which creating more events or more narrative scenes actually was easier?
I don't believe it. When you're working with the script, you should never write it in a linear way.
Yeah.
It's never, even if you're writing a common drama. I think that the first sequences should affect the last sequences, but in the opposite, the same way. The last sequences, they affect the first sequences in every script, not only in time travel scripts. For example, something that is said in the climax of the story maybe should have a resonance that has to be heard by the rest of the script. I don't know if I'm explaining well.
No, this makes sense. I mean, you wrote this script essentially, you had placeholders, this is a good scene, this scene works in this spot, and this scene works in this spot, but I don't quite know what's going to be in the middle, let me figure it out. You wrote the script this way?
It's about architecture. Yeah. It's funny because my character in the movie, he makes a draw on a wall, and I made a similar draw in order to make the script.
While you were writing the script?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's
what is funny is that I had this incredible lunch with Steve Salian. He's producing the remake.
Oh, yes.
He's the writer of Schindler's List, the director of... We are having lunch together, and he took this paper and he made this draw, and he was like, I can guess you make this draw when you were writing the script, and I was like, oh my god, Steve Salian is making the same draw I made. It's magic. It's about architecture. In order to make all the things fix with each other, all the things should match. It's like making a mathematical equation.
Yeah.
And it was pretty complicated, but what was most complicated for me was making something funny.
Yeah.
Because in this kind of movies, in this movie particularly, you're dealing with the unpredictable, but you are dealing with a lot of predictable things. You are dealing with what the audience know what's going to happen. So in the middle section of the film, you are telling the same thing from a new perspective. You're not saying something new. It's not about what, it's about how. So in order to telling all these things in a funny way, in order to avoid to boring the audience, that was my first concern.
Sure.
So my first concern was, was matching all the things together. But the second one was making something funny.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, you have Kara in the lead, and he's quite funny. At the beginning, he's just basically a mumbling schmuck, essentially, a schlub who just wanders around. I mean, did you rely on performance to bring out comic moments that you were uncertain of, that the performance would actually sell the comic moment more than your conception of the moment?
All my short films are comedies, open comedies.
Sure.
And this is my first thing that is not 100% a comedy. But when we were shooting the film, I couldn't avoid adding as much comedy as possible without changing the script.
Sure.
If you put the camera in a very specific angle, everything is terrifying. But if you put the camera in this other angle, everything is so ridiculous. So it's time I had this opportunity of showing the ridiculous side of the situation. I said, let's go, because for me, it's part of the charming of every story. If you're giving the audience the opportunity of laughing at what they're saying, because we're not talking about people in Guantanamo. We're talking about time travel.
Yeah.
This is not for real. If you want, this can be serious, But I'm giving you the opportunity of laughing at my characters and my situation. Sure. And at the same time, Carlos Lejalde is a very well-known comedian in Spain.
Yeah.
He acted in dark films in the 90s, being a psycho killer.
Yeah.
In amazing films like The Death Mother.
Yeah.
But lately, he was very known for comedies.
Yeah.
For me, he was perfect because he can be a clown mm-hmm. and a psychopath. Yeah. One second.
He took all his best bits of his career and put them into this.
Of course.
Oh, that's interesting.
So he's a genius in that sense.
What steps did you go to ensure the differing qualities of the three Hectors in this? Because he makes very subtle shifts when he comes out of the tank, and sometimes his walk is a little bit different.
Yeah.
Sometimes as another Hector comes out of the tank, he's more confident. Yeah. He has more of a look of like, well, is this the guy we saw at the beginning?
Yeah, he looks like some kind of superhero.
Yeah.
He becomes into this kind of time master or something. He turns into something more terrifying than the Pink Mummy itself.
Yeah.
So it's funny. Oh, our first tool in that sense was playing with different looks in order to playing with different moods. So I wanted to help the actor in the sense of having pretty different looks through all the sequences. The character is smashing his head onto the ground several times. smashing against the ground several times. In that sense, the physical transformation of the character really helps the inner transformation.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I haven't invented. This it happens in a lot of movies. When you are physically changing your character, it helps the character to transform from the inner side.
But I'm curious how much of this came from you and how much of this came from Cara. Because for one thing, I'm sure he had some ideas and you were able, obviously, to corral some of the best bits career. You know, and I'm curious,
for example,
what specific instructions?
Cara have amazing ideas. For example, at the beginning, he's wearing very, very inconvenient shoes if you want to walk through the woods, in a wood. He has shoes for be taken at home. So that's the reason he is walking so angry in the first sequences. Later he's wearing a real boot, so real steady boots. So when he's running in the second part of the movie, he's running with boots.
Yes.
So he has another way of walking.
Sure.
So he invented some of the devices that transformed itself into another character.
But it seems to me that some of your specific fashion choices, and I do want to talk about that too, because you had a challenge here. You have to come up with commonplace clothing that could be looked at and also be viewed as menacing, because we don't know that we may or may not know that it may be the same guy or whatnot, but at the same time, it has to be something that you can find in a car, you can find in a recreation center or whatnot. You were under very severe limitations to get this, and then it influences Cara's performance as well.
It's a pretty good question, and some of the things that really were messing with our heads when we were making the film. We don't have a hero in this movie. We don't have an anti-hero because the anti-heroes are cool too. We don't have a hero at all. We have an everyday man surrounded by everyday people. And nobody in these films looks like a common role in films. So we wanted to make you really hit the point. We wanted to make something that feels a universe that feels comfortable in some ways, but at the same time it feels like anger, and at the same time it feels like a creepy old movie from the 50s.
Sure.
So it's about working with costumes, it's about working with makeup, working with the lights, working with a lot of technical aspects.
Yeah.
So I could tell you for hours. Take by take, I could tell you which were the decisions we were making all the time, but it's so complex. But I really appreciate your telling me that, because sometimes you're making a lot of decisions in order to not jump from the screen.
Yeah.
You want to make a movie that works in a natural way, so you don't want to people to realize of all the effects you are putting on the screen.
Yeah.
So most of my decisions decision for my crew. They went in order to make something invisible on the screen.
Yeah, like the ladder, for example, on the house, which I actually noticed, you know, the first time, like, why is that ladder there? That doesn't make any sense. And you thankfully explained why that ladder is there later. Yeah.
So for some of the bad reviews of the movie in Spain, some of them, they felt like the movie was maybe too much amateur, too much improvised on the screen. And I really appreciate that bad reviews, because that means that somehow it worked.
Yeah.
If you feel like this is something improvised...
This was super planned, and they accused you of it being improvised.
If you think this movie has been improvised, it's an amateur stuff.
You did your job.
We triumphed in some way.
I also will have to ask you, though, there's a couple of minor quibbles I have. The first major quibble is, why in the Sam Hill does the woman, or Chica, basically take her clothes off? She didn't have to do that. She could have run away, and that's the entire plot hinges upon this particular moment. But simultaneously, there is this really funny idea, because essentially, if Hector had not actually gone to investigate her, it's almost as if there's this moral parable about fidelity going on.
Yeah, of course,
because
of course.
It's like his own temptation to see the naked flesh is what causes him to be locked into this thing. But simultaneously, I also have to say, well, you know, this is kind of ridiculous that she takes her clothes off without question. I mean, was there ever an explanation at any point, or what happened here?
What are you referring? Are you talking about why is she getting naked for the first time?
No. I'm talking about because he orders her to later.
Yeah.
And there's no question at all.
One of my tricks. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah.
She tries to escape, and he gets her.
Yeah.
And he gets her because this is pretty weird. He gets her because he remembers where she was. When he was seeing her the first time in the same place in a previously timeline. So it is pretty weird. He can get her. So comes a point in which she realizes this guy is pretty dangerous. He has something sharp in the mind, in their hands. So, and he's asking for something bizarre. And he does that. I know that I'm playing with...
Was this a situation that you couldn't quite find an answer for why she would do it, but it had to fit the needs of the plot? Is that what happened here?
In this movie, you don't have a specific ending.
Yeah.
But at the same time, and this is more complicated, you don't have a specific beginning.
Yeah.
Because when you go back in time, the effect comes before the cause.
Sure.
So... there's no beginning for this story. It's a closed loop.
Sure.
Everything happens because it has happened.
And for all we know, there are endless Hectors running around besides the three.
So which is the real nature of she getting naked?
Yeah.
Something that is not answered by the film. When you're dealing with this kind of closed loops in science fiction, there's theories that say if you go back in time and you give to yourself a clock, and in the future, you're supposed to go back in time and give to yourself the clock. Where does this clock comes from? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a narrative explanation. It comes from nowhere. So why a clock? And why not a key? Why a clock specifically? So the reason of a naked girl, something that maybe comes from the inner part of the brain of Hector. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a fantasy that comes for real for any reason. Maybe she is part of an experiment. I don't know. But I wanted to not to answer all the questions because my favorite reaction to this film is people talking about it when they go outside the theater.
Yeah,
I love people arguing about the film. People, even the people that are upset about the film, they talk a lot about the plot. They talk about a lot of the inconsistency of the plot, all the unbelievable things. And I love that. I love when a movie allows people to talk about it, for good or for bad.
Was this a situation where you didn't actually have an explanation? Just also, as well, the music that unexpectedly blares in almost every indoor environment, which I like that idea.
Yeah.
There's no explanation for why music is playing all over the place, including the Blondie song.
Yeah.
Yeah, yet at the same time, it creates a sort of strange atmosphere as well. Is this a situation along the same lines where it just felt right, but either you couldn't attach this directly to the elaborate plot, or it just worked in a kind of environmental sense? I mean, how much do you often do this in your
films? When you have made all the logistic of the story, yeah. When you've been logical,
yeah.
When you've been logical through all the morning, mm-hmm. you can break the logics in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. I think that when it comes to a point in which you are dealing with, you are being so respectful to the common sense, you are being so clear in terms of space and time, I think you have to break the rules somehow. And for example, we break a lot of rules in this movie in terms of music, in terms of sounds, in terms of some situations are clearly impossible, some of them. But that's something that Hitchcock took to the edge, took to the limits, and something we should learn from him. It's not about the real thing. It's about something that we don't know what it is, but it's not definitely the real thing. So you can mess with a lot of tricks. You can make a lot of tricks in order to make something that is significant.
Gotcha.
I think that if a movie is significant, that is the most important thing of all. And if there's a way to break the logics in a fair way. So,
I had a quick final question because we got to wrap this up soon. But I wanted to ask you about whether you used practical locations for two things. One, the time travel tank, which it's this really amazing vat, and I'm wondering if you had found a location that looked more or less like the time travel tank that you had planned, perhaps in the script, and then you just kind of dressed it up a little bit. And also the road with the lights on the side, which actually also serves as an advantage to you, because here you have this natural lighting and all you have to do is enhance what's already there. Did you plan for pragmatic locations?
Those two are the only fake sets of the film.
That's
all. The rest of the film, they are real locations. Mm-hmm. The ones you mentioned are the only that are fake. We wanted to focus all the efforts of the art department in that part of the story, and we didn't want to make this kind of a spectacular device that looks like trying to look like a Hollywood film. We wanted to make something that could be something real, something that will feel like a giant toy somehow, and something that could come from the 70s maybe or the 60s.
Sure.
Because I love the idea of maybe in 5 decades people get messed and get confused about this film, and maybe they think this film has been made in the 60s or in the 70s.
Yeah.
I love that idea of making something atemporal.
Well, the other thing, too, is that if you make it with today's latest gadgets, then it's going to immediately look like, oh, well, this is a 2007 movie, like 20 years from now. But now it's essentially, it could be viewed at any particular point.
On all the costumes and all the vehicles, it's something that I didn't want it to make something so close to the... to what you expect from movies at this year or at this era. I wanted to make something that felt like, when has this movie been made? And at the same time, it feels like a Spanish film, but at the same time feels like maybe a Russian film sometimes.
Sure.
I don't know. We wanted to deal with that.
Something perhaps that could be nestled right there in the 60s, which we were talking about at the very beginning of this conversation, where this is essentially a sort of timeless, or a movie that could have been made 20 years. Got you. Well, Nacho, we got to go here, but it was a pleasure chatting.
Right.
Thanks so much for the time.
Great interview.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.